And we all had to play piano plus something else. So my brother still plays violin in a rock band in the D.C. area. And my sister played flute. In Hartford, I went to school at Hart, and there I sang in a church choir outside of the school, in addition to being immersed in this conservatory. And I actually went to school there partly because I could also take other courses outside of music, but very intense. Moved here to New York, and even more intense, more competitive. So, and by then I'd sort of stopped going to church for a while. I was in a place where it was very fire and brimstone, and that turned me off. And started looking for a church to get married in, and looking around, and St. Paul and St. Andrew seemed like a really good place to be. So I've been there ever since.
So I'm here to talk about my film, Among the Believers, that I just recently finished, and how this has been a personal journey for me, making this film. So we can start by watching a trailer of Among the Believers, and then I can talk about how I went through this personal transformative experience while making this film.
यही तो फर्क है हमारी तालीम और स्कूलों कॉलेजों की तालीम हम ये सिखाते हैं कि आपने दावत की लाइन से जिहाद की लाइन से शरीयत की निफाज की लाइन से मेहनत करनी है
बमबारी की तरबियत दी जाती है जिस तरह की नफरतें बोई जाती हैं वो हमारे मदारिस के अंदर होती है अब हम इन लोगों को हरगिज हर सूरत बर्दाश्त नहीं करेंगे
रोशन ख्याली आपकी नजर और फिर आपकी का है कि पाकिस्तान में नहीं पूरी दुनिया में अल्लाह ताला इस्लाम निजाम नाफिज करा के
छोटे भाई शहीद हुए मेरी वालदा साहिबा शहीद हुई मेरे बेटे थे मौलाना हसन गाजी वो भी शहीद हुए अगर आप लोगों को ये पसंद नहीं है तो गिरफ्तार कीजिए शूट कर दीजिए लेकिन ये जहन में आप अपने रखें कि हमारे अंदर कोई तब्दीली आएगी ये भूल जाए
It's a very controversial film and a more controversial trailer. What this film talks about is the ideological battle that's going on in Pakistan. I conceived of this film after losing a very dear friend in Mumbai terror attacks in 2008. I was just so angry and I wanted to understand what's going on in Pakistan. And over a period of time, what I realized is that Pakistan is at war with him. And there is a fringe minority of extremist elements in Pakistan that are trying to force their way of life on the vast majority of Pakistanis. In fact, Pakistanis are the biggest victims of terrorism. And attacks such as the Mumbai terror attacks are happening in Pakistan almost on a monthly basis. And once I had that realization, I really wanted to make a film about the ideological conflict that is shaping Pakistan and, in fact, right now, most of the Muslim world. So I began on this journey in 2009. In 2009, I went to Pakistan. I was very clear that I wanted to tell both the sides of the story. And I followed a few children from a madrasa, from a religious, from a politically motivated madrasa such as Red Mosque. It's it's not an ordinary madrasa. It's a madrasa with a pure political agenda. So I was very clear that I wanted to follow a few students from such a madrasa and a few students from a regular school. And I wanted to see how their education shapes the way they see the world. And this film took 6 years to make. And in the process, I met with an amazing Pakistani co-director, Mohammed, who joined the project in 2010. And he brought this whole inner axis that I was lacking. You know, I was looking at it as an outsider, but he grew up in Pakistan. He was born and raised there, and he's a Shia minority Muslim. And he had seen his country transform just in one generation when these extremist organizations were trying to take control of the country. And he had seen his country change, and he brought that entire perspective. So we filmed this over 6 or 7 years, and it took a year and a half to edit. But you know, the final film is a balanced, nuanced perspective on trying to find grassroots solutions to war on terror. Because both I and Mohammed very strongly believe that if there is any solution to war on terror, it can only be found among the believers. Because the West always sees the war on terror as us against them, whereas the real battle is actually happening among Muslims. Because Muslims are the biggest victims of extremism. And we just tend to not see that. And that's what we really wanted to highlight in this film, is how this country has been at war forever, and Pakistanis are the biggest victims of terrorism. So that's my introduction.
Thank you very much, Jean.
So I sing. I have sung as long as I can remember, from early childhood. And to me, when we sing, of course, the main thing we do is use our breath, and to me that is spirit-given, spirit-driven. We are anointed with the breath that God gives us, and being able to share this throughout a lifetime, a career, has been one of my greatest blessings, and is something that I am extremely grateful for. I don't take it for granted for a minute. I wrote this to Jim when he asked me if I wanted to have any questions asked or anything, but I just wanted to share my thoughts that kind of bubbled out as I thought about my life, and I'm going to read a bit. Show business is obviously not the most secure of professions and is fraught with challenges as well as glorious mountain peak experiences. Without a firm spiritual foundation, it is easy to get discouraged, get self-absorbed, lose one's way, become lonely and lost. Not knowing what will come next, waiting for the phone to ring, however, is actually one of my favorite things about being an actress. What wondrous adventure is going to be next? Broadway, a national tour, living in Korea, as my husband and I did for several years, training professionals there, teaching voice, which I do now, and I teach it as a spirit-based art. In thinking about questions, thoughts range from the blessings of being established in a firm Christian family foundation during childhood and teen years that set the course for my theatrical journey. I came from a very musical family. We all played instruments. We sang. We're like the old movies. We'd get together. Even with my parents were divorced, but we'd get together and play and sing and have wonderful, wonderful music nights. Where am I? Mm-hmm. With all its ups and downs, rejections, starving artist days, like I happen to be in one now, which is okay. Prayers are welcome. As well as glorious and rewarding experiences, which I could go on forever, but we don't have that much time. To the blessings of finding and remaining deeply rooted in a community of believers, as I have found at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church, especially when coping with drastic life changes, such as my loss of my wonderful husband, and major career changes at this point in my life. I've reached an age where everything's different. Everything is different. Yes, the stories I could tell. Of rejections, of roads not taken, of perceived losses that are God's gain, of profound gratitude for, in my case, the gift of music song used to touch someone's heart and make a difference. And that is the prayer, my prayer, before every performance. Of standing firm when challenged to make a moral decision. Been there, done that. thankful for a Christian upbringing that taught me to honor God and not follow an earthly plan, of making mistakes and of forgiving others as well as forgiving myself. We artists are a passionate people. I don't know if you could even imagine what it feels like to fully know that God has planted these gifts in our hearts to use for His glory, and are most fulfilling when we allow Christ to walk alongside us and sometimes carry us on and off stage. It is always my goal to share my belief in however I present, whatever character I'm in, whatever experiences. I became the mother of so many theater companies. They're my family. We develop a very strong family in this industry. And, of course, the friends I cherish most are the ones that we connect with spiritually. And we keep each other going. We're here for each other. Music heals us. Music is our common language. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean. Thank you so much. Brian asked me to contribute my own little introduction, although we're going to spend more time talking with the panelists. My own understanding of religion and art in my life is fairly simple and very straightforward. You can tell I'm a Catholic priest, as I think I've said three times. I don't really consider myself a writer who is a Catholic priest or a Jesuit, but a Catholic priest and a Jesuit who happens to write. So all that I do and all that I write flows out of my vocation as a Catholic priest and a Jesuit. And the broadest explanation of that comes from the founding documents of the Society of Jesus, the formal name of the Jesuit order. The other Jesuit you may have heard of is Pope Francis, by the way, a.k.a. my boss. I think he's doing a pretty good job. In the founding documents of the Jesuits, St. Ignatius Loyola, our founder, said that the mission of the Jesuits is pretty simple. It's to help souls. Very simple, very broad. So anything I write is aimed at that. It's also designed, as Brian indicated, to help people find God in all things. That's another Jesuit ideal, finding God in all things. Overall, the aim of all that I do, including writing, which I suppose you could consider an art, is to help souls and to help people move closer to God. So for me, it is an explicit connection with everything that I do. But back to our wonderful panelists. I want to start with Melanie, if you don't mind. At first blush, being a concert violinist, being a musician of that type, may not seem, initially, to be something that draws on your religious beliefs, right? How does your belief express yourself in your music and what you play, in how you see yourself as a musician, and maybe even in the notes it says that you help younger artists as well, but how does that, I'm very curious, how does that kind of come out in your playing and in your own vocation?
I think, I do a lot of teaching, and so certainly there where you're trying to be patient and teaching the children to be patient with themselves, trying to teach them to be honest with themselves about what they're doing, and playing just sort of every note that comes out. On some level, I try to leave my ego out of it, which is hard work. A lot of times, just serve the music and let it go out to the people that are listening. And I think that's sort of, let it go to God, leave it to where it's going. So I would say those are the two things that come to
mind. So there's a kind of turning over of what you do to God?
You have to let it go. We work hard and try to get it perfect, and then you have to just put it out there.
Is there ever a conflict if you're teaching a child or a young person who's not religious and sort of expressing that in a way that they can appreciate it?
I think it can be said. I don't usually talk about God during the lessons. But I do talk about letting the music speak for itself and having set the foundation so that what comes out is what you're trying to express. They're trying to express themselves, their person, their spirit.
Thank you. Thank you. Hemal, you had mentioned this and in your opening remarks. What was it like for you collaborating with Mohammed, a Pakistani Muslim, to tell this story? What was that experience like for you, someone from a different religious tradition?
I met Mohammed in 2010. And when I met him, I knew that I wanted to collaborate with him. Because in order to tell the full story, I wanted to get somebody who is from that society and from that country and that religion, really. So when I first met him, I was really very convinced that I wanted to work with him. But it was Mohammed who was actually worried about working with me. Mohammed, you know, because I wanted to make a film on the Red Mosque. And Red Mosque is one of the most political madrasa networks in Pakistan. You know, it's almost like playing with fire. And he wanted to make this film on the ideological conflict, but he wasn't very clear about what point of view am I bringing to the table. Because he was afraid that it's going to be another reinforcement of a stereotype, a film that just basically talks about the same stereotypes that are in mainstream media, and that doesn't change the dialogue at all or doesn't advance the dialogue. But he came on board, and you know, over the years, like over 3 or 4 or 5 years, we actually started, you know, we started trusting each other. And what we started trusting each other on were these common cultural elements that we have. Because, you know, India and Pakistan have been the same country for 5,000 years. You know, it's the same land. We speak the same language. We watch the same movies. We eat the same kind of food. So we started connecting on culture. We started connecting on food and language and movies and songs. And, you know, that was the bond that connected us and united us and united the entire team. And it was also this bond of, you know, like mutual respect in our culture, both in Indian and Pakistani culture. Mehman Nawazi is what we call in Urdu. But what it is like, you know, treating your guest like your god and making sure that you stay a good host is very, very important. So we connected on that as well. So we both treated each other with a lot of respect. And we were open-minded. And although we were both from different religious faiths, our faith actually didn't change the way we saw things. And we connected over culture, which was really good.
Can I ask you, did you speak about your faith to one another? Did you say, this is sort of what Hinduism means to me? And did he speak to you about Islam?
Yes. We spoke about the faith a lot. And, you know, I'm a Hindu, but what I believe in the Advaita philosophy of Hindu, which is the philosophy of non-duality. As in, there's no division between me and God. I and God, all of us are from the same life energy. And when I said that, that's what I actually fundamentally believe in. Muhammad said, that's exactly what I believe in too. And that was just amazing. And then, you know, I think we also talked a lot about Sufism, because a lot of Sufi saints have come out of Pakistan, you know. A lot of them have influenced my worldview as well. So we connected over Sufism. We connected over common themes in our religion. And you know, we overall did realize that, you know, it's not that different, really. Like, the core philosophy is still the same.
Was that surprising to you to learn?
It wasn't surprising to me, because I have had Muslim friends growing up. You know, I mean, India actually has more Muslims than Pakistan. You know, we have 200 million Muslims, and Muslims are a part of our culture. I grew up in a predominantly Muslim neighborhood in India, so I wasn't surprised about these things. I knew about Sufism as well. You know, my anger was not towards Islam. My anger was towards terrorists who committed this crime. And I wanted to understand what motivates them. Because I knew it was not religion that motivates them. I knew it was something else, and I really wanted to understand that. And at the end of the day, I and Mohammed both agreed that it was really power that motivates them. not religion. They use religion to gain power.
Thank you very much. Jean, I have to admit I'm tempted to just ask you to sing right now.
Tale as old as time.
That's great. You have played, among other roles, as we said, Mother Abbess, The Sound of Music. How does being a believer influence your acting, and particularly if you could talk about what is it like when you play another person of faith? So you were playing someone who was a believer, Mother Abbess, but how does that influence the role?
Well, I believe that all roles that I get are God-driven.
In the sense that, in what way?
In that that's what I've been given, this, to find my way and to express my belief somehow through that role to people. I'm not a Catholic, I'm Presbyterian, but I love playing the Mother Abbess because I believe God, Spirit, speaks to his people as they need to hear him. And so that I'm open to the other faiths, to other religions, and I feel that being a Catholic is not—it's just a—it's a title, you know. In the role I was playing, it's a title. But I, as a person of Christian, deep Christian faith, I could identify with the Mother Abbess. So, as an actress, what we do is we use whatever is in us to create these characters. We have to identify with them. If it's something, if it's not the same circumstances, we find one that is similar, and we use those emotions. But it was such a joy to play that role because I totally believe in what she was, how she was helping Maria. You've all seen The Sound of Music, please tell me you have, with Julie Andrews.
Anyone who hasn't,
so,
please leave.
Oh, my God, yes, right. Out. No, she, so, and I believe that Maria and the mother, I've played Maria too for many years. And my sister, I have a twin sister, we used to run through the hills in Northern California singing, I mean, just like Maria. I was Maria. So I am her. And so when I got to play the Mother Abbess, not only was God in my heart for that, my mother was in that heart. We use the people that matter to us, that have meaning in our lives. And so, and I felt that they were the same people, and the Mother Abbess could guide her because she had that same decision to make early, and she knew her choice. So it's fascinating to, and the, Mrs. Potts is the heart of the castle. Well, that's not just a role description to me. That matters. That is a faith-based reality. It is truth. And so anytime I would even talk to students or, you know, we'd have talkbacks at the theater, that's where I explained that I was coming from as the heart of the castle. So I try to reach people through my faith in whatever role I can find.
So you talked about each part being God-given, a kind of call a little bit, if I understand you correctly.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about your own sense of vocation as an actress and maybe how an actor and maybe how that came about and how you see God's hand and all of that?
Well, God led me all the way because I wanted to be a psychologist. But I had been singing, truly, since I was like 3 with my sister. My whole family, we were singing from age 11 all over Northern California. It was something that bubbled up inside me. And that's what I believe is the God-driven part of who I am. And it just has evolved. The doors kept opening. And I think it's because I stayed prayerfully in my path, because I didn't know what would happen. And I truly meant that when I said I never knew what was going to happen next. I never knew what was going to happen next, and I totally trusted. And even at this stage in my life where everything is different, I'm open. God, now what? Where do you want me to go? So I really kept thinking I'd go back to school and get my master's, and yet the doors kept opening, and I kept just being so grateful for this opportunity of my life.
It's interesting. In the Jesuits, we talk about desire being a very important part of vocation, that, mm-hmm. you know, something bubbling up in you is the desire that you have is God's call, basically.
Incredibly. Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. And that's what it was. I felt that even when I'm most down at times, I'd go, what am I doing? What am I doing? And all of a sudden, I'd stop and I would, wait, I sing. I sing. That is a gift. Music is one of the greatest gifts we are given in this world. And the fact that I've been given that gift to share and to... I remember once I was singing in a concert, and one of the other principals became ill, and she couldn't sing, and the musical director asked me if I could. Well, what I didn't tell him was that I was fighting such a cold, but we were using music, and I said, yes, I can sing. I'll do it. I'll read her music. And at intermission, I felt horrible. I thought, this is sounding terrible. It's just awful. And a woman sought me out, And she said, whatever she was going through in her life, she was depressed, and she said, I heard you sing. And she said, all of a sudden, I felt healing. I felt hope. And the fact that she said that to me made that whole night worth it. That's what I pray for. That's the gift that I want to be able to share.
Well, it's also what Melanie was talking about in terms of kind of getting your ego out of the way. You know, I find in my own life as someone who preaches homilies that you could preach. I once preached at St. Ignatius Loyola, which is a Jesuit parish in New York, what I thought was the greatest homily ever, frankly. You know, we always say Jesuits are number one in all things, including humility. And I thought this was fantastic. And no one said anything afterwards. It's like, thank you, Father, goodbye, Father. And the next week, I was preaching a homily, which I thought was terrible. I mean, I really just sort of slapped it together, you know. And people were coming out with tears in their eyes. And so you never know. I mean, it's up to God.
Absolutely.
And that's part of kind of sort of stepping out of the way. Melanie, and by the way, if any of the panelists want to respond to anything anyone said, Melanie, I'd like to ask. Oh, please. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, one thing that struck me when you said was submission. And that is what I and Muhammad had in common when we started working. We did submit to the process of making this film together. And both of our religions believed in it. So that was another common thing that we found between Hinduism and Islam, was actually submitting to the way the wind takes us.
And isn't that what Islam means? Submission? Yeah. Thank you. Melanie, I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit more about this idea that Jean brought up about vocation, how you see God as, you know, if we could use the word calling you to that or maybe drawing you to that, and also how that idea of vocation plays out in perhaps in your teaching. But could you talk a little bit about your idea of vocation in the arts?
Was interested in Spanish and music. And I applied a couple of places to be a double major, and they didn't work out. And so I ended up, but I couldn't imagine not doing music. So I guess from that point of view, that's vocation.
Where did that come from? I mean, was that early on?
Not as a teenager, I guess. I was later than some musicians, you know, immediately. That's what they were. It wasn't like that for me. For kids, I guess what I try to instill in them, I mean, being a musician is hard, and you never know when the work is going to come and when it isn't, or if you'll get a job, or if you won't, or when the work will come in and when it won't. So I actually steer clear of saying you should be a musician, you should be a music major, but I do try to instill in them a love of doing it, a love of playing with their friends, a love of hearing, of actually being able to turn a beautiful phrase, actually feeling like their soul is coming out in the music. And if that leads them, I mean, I have had students who went on to become musicians, if that leads them there, then fine. And if it doesn't, then we have people who would love to be in the audience, which we also need.
Do you, can you talk about experiences where you have been performing? You felt that connection to God, or you felt that connection to something larger?
Sure, playing in church.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
We played, there are a group of musicians actually at St. Paul and St. Andrew. And so sometimes for Easter last week or at Christmas time, a bunch of us will get together. And that's can be really great. I mean, again, you put your ego aside and pour yourself into making this great music. And
is there a sense of God helping you? What in the Catholic tradition we would call grace, you know, God helping you?
I would say that the congregation makes it a safe place to be able to reveal yourself. And I think that's a big part of what makes it so joyful.
Do you ever feel a connection? I have some musician friends who say they feel a spiritual connection with the composer as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
I have some friends, and we'll get together and play chamber music, string quartets, quintets, and there are certain composers where you just say, let's play Brahms, and everyone says yes. And, you know, the music is so glorious that, you know, you just, that's like being in church, like praying.
Thank you. Very helpful. Himal, you had touched on this, you started to talk about how your work with Muhammad changed your view of him and a little bit of Islam. How did it change your view of Pakistan? And what was your view before, and how did it change your view?
The truth is that I actually never thought much about Pakistan, except that I was meant to hate it. You know, that was just my conditioning. The way it's just Indian media reinforces it, Indian culture reinforces it. Indians have always seen Pakistan as an enemy nation. And that's it, right? We've fought 5 wars, and our economies have suffered because of that and stuff like that. So I didn't actually think about Pakistan until I went to Pakistan and until I started making this film. And after I went to Pakistan, I've had, like, so many experiences where, you know, one time I was in Lahore. Lahore is a city in Pakistan, and I was at a lassi stall. They were making lassi. Lassi is a yogurt drink. And they were making lassi, and I was at a lassi stall, and I and my co-producer, Musharraf, we were talking about Bollywood films and some silly things in it. And I speak Urdu, but I have a different accent. So the lassi stall maker, he picked up on my accent, and he said, "Are you from India?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Oh, then you're my guest." And he served me free lassi. And, you know, I've had that experience in other restaurants as well, where the restaurant owner found out that, she is from India, so they gave me a free lunch or a free meal or something. Then where the hotel that I was staying in, you know, the intelligence agencies in Pakistan, they were, I don't know why they saw me as an enemy. So there were always intelligence agencies following me, like somebody from the intelligence following me all the time. So the hotel receptionist would always tell me, you know, your friends had just come by. I just wanted to let you know. I never felt threatened in that society. I never felt like I was different. And there was not a single time when I actually felt that Pakistanis would gang up against me and kill me. I never felt like that. Like, I never felt like my life was in danger. In fact, I blended in so effortlessly. And we used to live in New Jersey, and my husband, you know, was saying that we should go to India next time. And I said, you know, I just been to Pakistan. I really don't want to go to India again. So, you know, I had that similar cultural experience. I said, I need to just go back and work now and earn some money. But the country is just, I personally feel like, you know, if our politicians and our religious leaders get together and erase the border somehow, magically, then there will be no difference between the two countries. I really feel that, sincerely. That's a secret agenda that I and Muhammad have. But I don't think we'll be able to accomplish it in this lifetime. But who knows?
You had talked about feeling a little bit in danger, right, at times. How does your, I don't know much about Hinduism, how does your faith help you in those moments? Or even just in difficult moments, you know, when you were making the film, how does your faith, how do you draw upon that?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I don't know if it's Hinduism. I think it's just universal spirit. But I really strongly believe in submission. I believe that I believe that I should just go in the direction that the wind takes me. I was like that when I met my husband. I almost fell in love within a day, and we got married within 6 months. And, you know, we've been married for 12 years. We are now married for 12 years. And that's how I was with my marriage. That's how I am with my career. So that's how I am. I was with this film as well. I had this deep, intense emotion, and I wanted to use my art to make sense of this deep, intense anger. And I basically submitted to this process of inquiry. So I didn't know I was going to make a film on Red Mosque, or I was going to collaborate with Muhammad, or this film was going to take 6 years. And, you know, I didn't know that all these intelligence agencies would follow me. Like, I had not planned for any of that thing. But it all turned out good, you know. And like right now, it's the film, like everybody in Pakistan also is proud of the film. Like every single team member is proud of the film. And, you know, I think it's just basically submission. I very strongly believe in submitting.
Thank you. Very helpful. Very interesting. We at lunch, we were talking about the process of auditioning and how that can be difficult for both an actor and a musician, and how it can, you know, sometimes make a person, I have some actor friends, feel like you're going in and you're being rejected. So actors have told me they go in and they say, you know, up or down, basically. And so I'm wondering, Gene, can you talk about how your faith helps you in those kinds of difficulties and also in just kind of the challenges of being an actor?
Yes. Auditions are not our favorite thing. It's very difficult to go in because all you can do is bring yourself into it and the work that you've prepared. Once you step in that door, there is no guarantee, there is no job, basically. You know, they either like you if you're, yes, you can have great auditions, or you can have bad auditions, but you have the right hair color, or you're the right height. Early on when I was in high school, I lost a role because I was too tall for the leading man. And I was right for the role, and I knew it. But for some reason, since I remember saying this to somebody in the fifth grade, God has a better plan. So for me, that's how it helped me. Now, I tell my students, mourn something you lose. Mourn something. You can mourn it. I had another experience. It was a major Broadway show. A star was coming in who had been on Broadway. He was very nervous. The producers wanted me to do the role. I had just finished doing it someplace else. I'm not going to name names. That's why I'm being very general. And I auditioned, and it happened to me a really good audition. And I'm not the best auditioner. I like to work into a role. So I didn't get it because he felt a bit threatened. That happens.
Because you were too good?
My experience, yeah. And so I was upset. And so the producers called me. They had negotiated with somebody else. They said, Gene, we've stopped negotiations. We want you for this role. We're going to try this again. I went in again. I didn't get it. I cried because it was a huge step. However, within the very week, and I won't even go into all the details, I met my husband and married him, and we had a 30-year enchanted marriage. I would not have met him. I knew him. It would not have worked out that we would have gotten married. And so a Broadway show for a year or two, a 30-year enchanted marriage,
So you do have a sense of God's plan.
God had a better plan.
God's plan, yeah.
But I also know that it was all right for me to mourn it, to just let it out and go on.
Well, it's real. I mean, we look at, characters and the people in the Bible who have to, you know, sort of express themselves to God and say, you know, why is this happening? You know,
there's a lot of whys in the building. But so we have to know that we are who we are. We go in, we do the best we can do, and then let it go and go on.
Thank you. Also, submission, basically,
submission.
And getting out of the
Absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely, I love that.
I want to leave time for questions. We have about 10, 15 minutes for questions from the audience. So to any of our panelists, to me, any questions, you can jump up and shout them out, and I'll repeat them back or anything.
So if you like, maybe what you can do is come and line up here. And when you're asking questions, please say what your name is and what organization you're from. So just come
and
on,
while that's
come on
happening,
down.
I just want to thank everybody for this invitation and for being here. And thank you, Jim. This has been really quite rewarding. Thank you.
I remembered something. I play spiritual sometimes in church, which is also very much like praying. And
well, you were also saying that auditions, which I hadn't thought of in terms of musical auditions were difficult. Can you describe what happens?
Orchestra, it was fascinating
to me.
In an effort to have a more diverse orchestra, the orchestras normally hold their auditions behind a screen. So in a room this size, there would be a big screen in the middle, and you would walk in behind it. You would wear sneakers so that they wouldn't know that you were a woman, and you wouldn't speak. Somebody says, play this piece, and you play it, and they say, okay, that's enough, now play that one. And sometimes you wonder, is there more than one person out there? are they really there? Is it a tape recording? So it's a little disorienting. And sometimes that's helped, I think. And sometimes I have friends who've been on the committee who know that there was somebody who knew which number the person they wanted to hire had, so it wasn't really anonymous. But sometimes it does work.
I imagine, does it feel, I've never had that experience, does it feel depersonalizing at all, or as if you're just your music, or how does it make you feel?
Well, I think to play an audition and they can't see you, and you think you played well, but you still didn't get it. You know, it's very, I think it's easier to play when you can see the people's faces, but that's not the way it is. So.
But rejection is the name of the game. That is what's hard, and that's what's hard to train younger people coming in with. How do you handle that? And you really have to have a strong sense of self. And to me, that is a Christian-based self. So, or a supportive family. I had the best supportive family. We need those. We need each other in our lives. It's all about relationships. It's all about the people. And if we have that support, we can go on.
I think for any artist, even in writing, believe it or not, we get articles. I work at American Magazine, which is a Catholic magazine, and we'll get articles in. And I mean, I've experienced lots of rejection and people saying no to articles or books or whatever. And just the other day, we had someone write an article in. Also, I will have it pretty anonymous. And the person's pouring their heart out, and it's a story about how they overcame difficulties with an illness, with a life. You know, and this is like their life, basically. And I read it, and I thought, nah, we just had one of those, you know, reject. And so, you know, it can be, you know, as a writer, you're pouring yourself out, and it can feel like it is not. It is not a rejection of their experience, but it's a sort of a professional rejection, basically, which can feel like they didn't think my experience with, you know, overcoming cancer was good enough, basically. So, yes, question?
Yes, my name is Larry High, and I'm from the United Methodist Churches of Northern California, Northern Nevada. And question, if you would mind, any of you, talking about your creative process and what you do when you're creatively blocked, writer's block, musically blocked, what do you do to break through that stalemate?
Great question. I'd like to hear from each of them. I'll say something funny. In writing, the joke is, if you feel writer's block, the answer is to immediately lower your standards. So, please, go ahead.
I would say the block for me is practicing. You have to just sometimes just get out and go for a walk and come back and refocus. Sometimes it's as simple as that.
How about your process in general?
Trying to practice every getting up and doing stretches and then practicing and then going for a walk and then practicing some more. Sort of trying to figure out what the priorities are for what's the toughest thing that I have to handle and try to do that first.
The toughest part of the piece, you mean?
Yeah.
I'm an editor, and you know, sometimes I've had to re-edit a scene 50 times because it didn't quite represent the point of view that the director was looking for. And even in this film, Among the Believers, there were a few scenes that were crafted over and over and over again just to make sure that it had the finesse. I think that the biggest thing is really just constantly do it. Treat it as an exercise. Do it regularly, even if you hate doing it. Do it again and again and again and again, and not get tired of it, really. It's just, I think tenacity is the way to remove blocks.
What do you mean, when you say do it as an exercise, what do you mean by that? You mean continue
Like sometimes, you know, you don't want to wake up at 6 a.m. and run, but you still go and run because it's important for your body to do that. It's the same thing with the scene. Like when I'm editing a scene, you know, I don't want to edit it because my head is hurting because the scene is like too complicated, but I still do it and I still edit it. Even if it's sloppy, I don't judge it. You know, I still just put some work in it because it's important to just constantly keep putting work in it and have a strong work ethic. I think that is the only thing that removes blocks eventually. And I think blocks don't ever get removed. I think blocks get dissolved. They dissolve slowly and steadily with work ethic. That's what I've noticed.
And I've noticed sometimes that blocks are a way of stopping you to rethink it, try something else. My process has always been very, very disciplined. Exercised every day of my life until I had hip replacements. And it's hard for me now to get that discipline back to stretch and work physically, because that's our instruments. In my case, my instrument is my body. So to keep it toned and keep it in shape, that is the very important to try to memorize every day, to sing through. Even now there are songs I can't sing once my husband died because he's still in them. I can't sing them. And the other day I was in the rehearsal studios and just started crying. I thought, I'm going to sing this. I'm going to get through this. I've just got to get through it. So it's perseverance. It's discipline. But the thing is, it's all joyful. And if I really come to a dead end, I do what a book called The Artist's Way suggests. I go on an artist date. I go to the museum. I go take a walk in a park. Something that clears the cobwebs and helps me have a new perspective.
Yeah, and I also find as a writer, for me, I don't have writer's block too much, but I have blocks in terms of how something's working on the page, and I know that is not working. I mean, that just is not working. And the old expression, killing your darlings, right? You've heard that expression, you have to get rid of it. I just did that the other day. I had to kill one of them. But I think to be able to take outside advice as a writer is very important. To be able to be edited well, they always say the best writers are the ones that are able to be edited because they're used to that. I had an experience where I was writing a book and on the saints, and each chapter had sort of a funny story at the beginning to lead up to the story of the saint's life, you know, how I kind of came to know this saint. And I had this one chapter on Thérèse of Lisieux, who's a French Carmelite nun, and I, for a number of reasons, I told three funny stories about working in a movie theater as a kid, and they were all funny. I thought they were funny. And it was leading up to the fact that I met, in a sense, Thérèse of Lisieux in a movie called Thérèse, not surprisingly. And so the editor at Loyola Press wrote back and said, I'll never forget this, and I use this for young writers. She said, one story is the lead up, not three. And I said, no, they're really funny. People like my funny stories. She said, no, one is enough. It's too long. It's too many digressions. One's enough. No, I think it's funny, too, and I'll make the book a lot lighter. And she said, I'll never forget this. I could quote it. If I, says the editor, who am getting paid to read your book, thinks there are too many stories, what will people who pay to read your book think? And I said, okay, fine. Because, you know, as a writer, you can't say, well, this makes sense or this works. If your readers say, no, it doesn't, you can't say, yes, it does. You know, I mean, it doesn't. You're not communicating it. Yes.
Good afternoon. Brian Gray. I'm retired, but I formerly worked for the National Catholic Educational Association. The prior panel today of media writers said that one of the frustrating issues they had was in covering the religious holiday story. How do you make it fresh year after year after year? Yet you, Father, got two pages about the resurrection in the Wall Street Journal on Easter week. How did you pull that off?
I bribed them by giving them $10,000. No, I you know, it's funny. So I had this piece in the Wall Street Journal. It was the strangest thing. They, you know, as Brian said, I'm on, you know, Rolodexes and stuff. So I got a, people don't even know what Rolodexes are anymore. I got a call from the, you know, interesting. It was funny how this happened. About a month ago, I got an email from the Wall Street Journal saying, will you write an article on women preachers? Which is, well, right, because I'd written something. And, you know, in the Catholic Church, that's something of a, other churches, it's not a controversial proposition. In the Catholic Church, it is, because it has overtones of women's ordination, right, which is verboten, basically. But I'd written a piece saying how important it was to hear women's voices. So they said, will you write a piece on women's ordination, women preaching? And I said, will it be behind a paywall? Because the journal has a paywall. And they said, yes. And I said, well, if I write something on women preaching, I don't want the Vatican to hear stories about it and not be able to read it, right? So I don't want to write for something behind a paywall. So they said, all right. So a week later, they said, how about something on Easter? And I said, will it be behind a paywall? And they said, no. And I said, great. So I wrote this long 2,000-word piece, which is crazy long for, you know, these days in journalism. Very religious, super religious. So it could have been a homily. Because I always feel you go 110% religious, and then they always pair you back, the secular media. They just do, because they say, well, it's a little too religious. They accepted it as is. So I got this homily on the front page of the review section of the Wall Street Journal, the big picture of Jesus. So, and someone wrote, I have a public Facebook page, someone wrote, the only bad thing was that it appeared in the mouthpiece of Mammon. And I no, and I said that's exactly where I wanted it to appear. I mean, that's, you know, you have to take the message there. So it was a nice sort of Easter gift for me. So anyway.
Hi, I'm Carol from, I blog at Cry Peace, and I love photography, poetry, videography, so I really appreciate that you're doing a panel on the arts. Where can emerging artists get published in religious or secular media?
I could say religious art, you mean sort of fine artists, basically? Or yeah. You know, that's a great question. There's more and more places, I think, online today, of course. Most people still like to be in print. Most artists still like to be in print. I'm sort of struggling here. I think that if you're a photographer or an illustrator, magazines are still the way to go. There's probably a lot of people from religious media here. But yeah, I'm sort of drawing a blank. I think the traditional places, plus online, basically, if that helps.
Thank you.
Sure.
Maybe a little follow-up question on hers. Let's say if you're trying to get something that you write picked up, and you've been a gatekeeper for this type of thing, what are some tips, Father Jim, that you might offer to people who are writing to an editor to get something picked up?
Well, let's see. I would say, as we were saying in this panel, don't be afraid of getting rejected. Boom. That's the most important thing. People say, oh my gosh, my article got rejected. Yeah, no kidding. Right? What does that mean? It means the editor got up on the wrong side of the bed in the morning. They read two articles that were just like yours. So just part of it is just sort of turning it over and being okay with that. We've all been rejected up here.
Don't take it personally.
Don't take it personally, right. And continue to do it, right? Continue to sort of try. I would say in general, for the religion media, make it accessible. Don't write for just the people that are in your little circle. I call it Catholic land. Right? I mean, you try to anticipate the fact that if you're writing for the Wall Street Journal, people aren't going to know what the hell a sacrament is, right? You need to explain that to them. Excuse my French. Accessible. And the most important thing is, I think, take people where they are. Right? Meet people where they are. Speak in their language and be accessible. And also, be short. Don't send... It's so funny. America will say, like, you know, our limit is 1,500 to 2,000 words. You would be amazed at the number of, particularly academics, who write in and say, here's my 10,000-word article. It's a little long. Would you mind cutting it back? And we say, thank you very much. You know, so it's accessible, shortness, things like that. Any other comments or wrap up? Yeah.
I can talk about video. I think that, I think the best thing is like Jim said, that, you know, don't try to package too much in it. Don't test their patience. Like, don't write 500 words when you can actually finish your message in 50 words. Like, just be precise, concise, and just that's all I can say. Because I have noticed that whenever I have submitted rough cuts or anything that are sloppy, there is a higher... I have been rejected more. So I actually just like to submit finished work. Even if they ask for just an assembly, you know, like sometimes a funder would say, oh, I just want to see an assembly to get a sense of what you have. I actually know what they're asking for. They're asking for a finished product. Like, not a very finished product, but a semi-finished product. And so I never just send them a rough assembly. I send them a finished product. I put that extra 2 or 3 or 4 days of work that is needed to make sure that the thing looks consumable.
Yeah, and in terms of being short, I always say no one doesn't like short. As an exercise, I tweeted out a year or two ago all the Beatitudes. They're all under 140 characters. Yeah. Right, so if Jesus could say something in 140 characters, so can we. Right.
And in terms of short, I think we have to close now. But I'm going to make two announcements. But first, thank you very much to all our panelists.
Thank you.